Migrant kids in detention today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A former youth care worker says life for immigrant kids at a detention center for children was so bad, he quit.
You would be going up and down a hall and hearing kids crying for their mom and they don't know what's happening and you can't tell them anything because the laws are changing every day.
Plus, Donald Trump sings the praises of American coal, but in the UK, British coal will soon be history.
It cannot be satisfactory for an advanced economy like the UK to be relying on polluting, carbon-intensive, 50-year-old coal-fired power stations. Let me be clear, this is not the future.
Plus, Mexico's win over Germany in the Soccer World Cup tournament was a seismic event, literally. That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's Monday, and probably no need to sum up the news. It seemed to alarm many of us this weekend. Children in detention along the U.S.-Mexico border. Families separated. The U.S. government has both said it isn't happening, but it's also defending the actions and explaining that it's meant to deter more people from coming across the border. The pushback has been widespread. It's come from Democrats, but also from Republicans, religious leaders, pundits, and comedians, a former president, and a former first lady. Still, President Donald Trump spoke today at the White House about his administration's so-called zero-tolerance immigration policy, and he's not backing down.
The United States will not be a migrant camp, and it will not be a refugee-holding facility. Won't be. You look at what's happening in Europe, you look at what's happening in other places, we can't allow that to happen to the United States, not on my watch. For the rest of the world, you look at everything that's taking place, pick up your newspapers this morning, and you see. We want safety and we want security for our country.
Trump repeated the false claim that his administration's hands are tied because of laws put in place by the Democratic Party. In fact, there is no such law that says children must be separated from their parents at the border. But there is a new policy under the Trump administration that refers all unauthorized immigrants for criminal prosecution. So what is the solution? Here is Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking earlier today.
We do not want to separate parents from their children. You can be sure of that. If we build a wall, we pass some legislation, we close some loopholes, we won't face these terrible choices.
We want to have a closer look at what's actually happening on the ground in the facilities where these immigrant kids are being held. For one perspective, we turn to Antar Davidson. Davidson was employed as a youth care worker at Estrella del Norte, or North Star. That's a shelter for detained immigrant children in Tucson, Arizona. It's run by a nonprofit called Southwest Key. Davidson was troubled by what he saw at the facility, so last week, he resigned.
The thing is I joined initially very excited to be taking part in this. Southwest Key Programs presents itself as a humanitarian nonprofit organization. And the things that I did like about the job were I did have a very solid chance to really connect with the kids. I got to really get to know these kids very well. There were very few people, unfortunately, that made an effort to get to know these kids personally, learn their names, learn their stories a bit, learn their languages. I got one phrase in Quiche that I keep in the back pocket, which is a Guatemalan indigenous dialect. But the connection that I was able to have with the kids was extremely important and is what kept me there, even when I didn't want to be there. But it came to a point where even though I felt that I was doing so much for them internally, working there, I would be eventually asked. I had already been asked and would continue to be asked to do things that I felt I was morally opposed to. So I had to resign as a conscientious objector.
Things such as what? What were you being asked to do that you were morally opposed to?
The first and I think most visceral for me, there were three Brazilian siblings that came, and basically I started translating for them. They were very confused, crying. He had understood that his mother was disappeared. The 16-year-old boy, he thought his mother was disappeared. In Brazil, when the government tells you someone's disappeared, it doesn't mean that they're being processed somewhere else. It means that oftentimes it can mean that they are dead. I had to calm him down. Then I had to supervise them in a classroom. And in that classroom, it was like there was just seats. And I was told to just show them movies. And they were asking me, like, can we go to a bed? We need to sleep. They were separated from their mom the night before. They left their facility in Texas at 2, arrived at our facility at 9, and it was now 5 o'clock, and they hadn't been given a bed to sleep in. So I basically had to sweep the floor for him so that this boy could sleep on the floor.
Now, Jeff Sessions initiated the zero tolerance policy back in April. Did you notice a difference at the shelter when the zero tolerance policy came into effect?
Oh, a very acute and sharp difference. Prior to the zero tolerance policy, there had been essentially an established route of migration, right? So the kids, the majority of the kids, it was a fairly homogenous population in that the majority of them were from Guatemala. They knew the drill, right? They paid a guide. They were trained on what would happen. They came with their documents. They came with their sponsors' information. They were told, you know, present yourself to the Border Patrol. You'll spend a few months in this facility. They'll teach you. They'll feed you. They'll clothe you, and then you'll be sent on a plane into school and to your sponsor. So it was for that reason, and also for the reason that they were fairly homogenous, they were much more compliant, right? And the shelter was able to operate on this private prison model of providing minimal services while reaping as much as they can of the grant, worked because they were compliant. But when the zero tolerance policy took effect, it wasn't semi-older kids that knew what they were getting into and were coached. It was a much larger amount of very young children, around 5, 6, 7, that had just been ripped from their parents' arms. So these kids were screaming. Some kids were actually hitting employees and throwing chairs at windows and putting the kids to bed. Not only were the kids at their most rebellious, right? That's when you see a kid's real feelings is when they're tired, right? So they're acting out extra. And at the same time, you have an underpaid and overworked staff trying to manage that. And it was really just really a mess. You would be going up and down a hall and hearing kids crying for their mom and they don't know what's happening and you can't tell them anything because the laws are changing every day. So there was definitely a very tangible difference that happened over the course of the rollout of the zero tolerance policy.
Now, Estrella del Norte, this is technically a shelter, right? So nobody's being detained. The kids actually can leave whenever they want. Am I correct about that?
Technically, they're supposed to, but the Tucson facility was essentially had the highest rate of runaways in the entire Southwest Key. And so we had a lot of people come and we were constantly adding these policies of double observation and a guard at this door, a guard at that door.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what can you tell us about kids trying to scale the fence surrounding the shelter?
So they did. Sunday the 27th, 3 kids successfully did. Southwest Key responded by basically putting up huge mesh fences all around. They doubled their fence capacity. They maintain a kind of a nebulous status of whether or not the kids can leave whenever they want. I would argue that they most definitely can't. This is why I was so disillusioned by Southwest Key. I thought initially that the work of Southwest Key was to help these kids resettle, help prepare them to go into public schools, provide them with services to help them get over the trauma and ultimately lead successful lives. The stated mission statement of Southwest Key is to make these kids' dreams come true. But when they get there, I realized that it was being run pretty much exactly like a private prison. And the management mostly were treating these kids as pretty much dollar amounts with no concern for their mental health.
Well, Southwest Key says they have very high professional development standards. They pay staff to work overtime and have mounted a very aggressive hiring campaign. The staff also must be bilingual and they get 80 hours of training. So would you call them unprofessional or overworked?
I would say overworked and understaffed. Southwest Key job postings are everywhere. And the job reviews are also posted everywhere in terms of affirming a lot of the problems I've said.
Antar, it's my understanding that Estrella del Norte started under the Obama administration. How differently was it run then?
So the employees that were there when the facility initially started, they also on numerous occasions talked about the kind of direction that it had taken since it started in becoming more prison-like, less focused on preparation and more focused on just getting them through. Also, if you look at the funding, the funding started at about $24 million and in 2018 went up to $300 million. So the Obama administration, I would say, is guilty for this program being a huge moneymaker for one specific individual. They have acquired, they claim, over $100 million in in assets, the organization, which are privately owned assets that were paid for with public funds. That's in the hand of the previous administration. There is indeed, if one is honest about the immigration situation in this country, it's been a problem for a long time. The zero tolerance policy basically broke the delicate balance of providing the minimal services to meet compliance while skimming off as much on the top as possible. So it was that set up by the previous administration, but it was broken by the zero tolerance policy law.
Antar Davidson was a youth care worker at Estrella del Norte in Tucson, Arizona, until last Tuesday when he resigned. Antar, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show and the opportunity to share my story.
By the way, we have reached out to Southwest Key, and we're hoping to hear back.
What I would like to hear from the critics is, what alternative way of enforcing our border do they suggest?
Mark Krikorian is the executive director for the Center for Immigration Studies.
What we tell people by releasing them if they bring kids with them, which is a relatively recent phenomenon, what we tell them is that if you bring a child with you, you will be released. In fact, that's why it's happening. Before 2014, it was very rare for anybody to bring a kid with them across the border. I mean, really, who would do that? You'd only do it if you had an assurance that it would help you, that you would be able to get away with it. And that's what President Obama's policies, as well as some specific legal provisions and court settlements, do. They tee up a situation where if you come in with a child, you cannot be prosecuted, and if you claim asylum, you can't be detained. You'll be let go. So if we're serious about enforcing the border, there's really no alternative to doing this.
Well, the critics say the Trump administration does not have to follow this policy. They choose to. And they also say that we should go back to the pre-zero tolerance policy that was enacted by Jeff Sessions in April and then urgently get to some kind of immigration reform.
Well, the zero tolerance policy was actually started in 2005 along certain narrow sections of the border. Back then, pretty much all illegal aliens were adults, not kids. Essentially, what we're talking about here is that kids have become a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card for illegal immigrants, and that cannot be allowed to continue.
Well, it sounds more like this was a bad policy that just got worse over time, and now it's being used to deter people. And do we really think it's working?
Well, it's too early to tell whether it's working. But
so how long do you wait to see if it's working?
There's a couple of things here. First of all, it's relatively recent policy, so we're not going to know for a while. It's going to take a couple of months for people's expectations to be changed. And secondly, the statistics that have been released about how many kids have been separated from their families don't report how many were then reunited with their families when they were returned to their home countries. Because this has been going on for a couple months, and they aren't all those kids are not still in detention.
But are you saying that it's okay for a kid, not knowing where their parents are, to be separated from them for up to 2 months? I mean, that's traumatizing for a child.
I'm sure it is. I don't like it. I wish we didn't have to do it. But it's the parents who have chosen to put their children into this situation. The alternative is that if you bring a kid with you, you are exempt from prosecution. That's what it boils down to. And I need somebody to explain to me how that leads to any situation except even more kids being brought over the border because the kid serves as a get-out-of-jail-free card for the illegal immigrant.
That doesn't absolve anybody from deportation, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. But what it does is that we release them into the United States and then we don't see them again because either they claim asylum, we can't detain them because of legal restrictions. Let me put it this way. If they claim asylum, we can't detain them together because of legal restrictions. So if we let them go, they're not going to show up when their hearing date comes up a year, 2, 3 years from now. The other alternative situation is that they don't claim asylum, but they're prosecuted.
Mark Krikorian, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
Mark Krikorian is the executive director for the Center for Immigration Studies. Coming up, coal in the UK, it's history. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World.
We have ended the war on beautiful, clean coal.
That pro-coal message from President Trump was part of his State of the Union address in January. Restoring the glory days of the U.S. coal industry has been a cornerstone of his presidency. He's also said global warming is a hoax and dismisses concerns about coal's major role in disrupting the Earth's climate. On the other side of the Atlantic in the United Kingdom, the war on coal really is over, and coal has lost.
It cannot be satisfactory for an advanced economy like the UK to be relying on polluting, carbon-intensive, 50-year-old coal-fired power stations. Let me be clear, this is not the future.
Amber Rudd there, the UK's former energy secretary, announcing 3 years ago that the UK would soon stop burning coal. It was a stunning move for a country where coal power launched the Industrial Revolution. So what's up with these two very different approaches to coal in the UK and the US? We sent the world's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler to the heart of English coal country. Here's part one in her two-part series.
Yorkshire has been called England's Texas, but without the sun and guns. It's an energy powerhouse where farms and villages sit on top of vast coal fields. Today, a vintage engine still lowers a cage elevator into a mine that opened in the 1700s. But it's not miners going underground anymore.
Kids, listen to me!
It's kids visiting the National Coal Mining Museum, which opened after the mine closed in the 80s.
Say bye-bye!
Sean McLaughlin is showing me around the old mine, including its stables.
We keep the ponies here. Morning, Alison.
Morning.
These will be used to pull the tubs of coal underground. Come on.
McLaughlin has neatly trimmed grey hair and an impish grin. He grew up in public housing in a nearby village. His dad and grandfather were miners, and he became one at age 16.
When people went to the local schools, it was sort of taken that unless they went on to university, they would just move into coal mining, basically.
McLaughlin got college paid for, and he was on the management track. But early on, he put in his time in the dark, hot pits.
The humidity was over 90%, so it was really, really arduous, and with the dust and the heat, so yeah, it takes a toll on the body.
The work was hard, but the camaraderie that was built underground rose up to the surface. The mine where McLaughlin started out had its own social club and even brass band. Now, McLaughlin is almost in awe of the fact that the kids who come to the museum have no connection to coal.
There's children now growing up that don't know what coal is. Once they stop burning coal, they'll not realise that coal fueled the Industrial Revolution of Great Britain and put us where we are on the map.
It's almost impossible to overstate the importance of coal to the UK. The first successful steam engine was invented to pump water out of British coal mines. Coal heated the country's homes. It powered the railroads and ships and factories that built Britain's empire. It helped the country survive two world wars. And at its height, more than a million people worked in coal mining. That number began to fall in the 1920s with mechanization and declining demand for coal. But those job losses stopped for a while in the 1970s when the oil crisis hit the UK. Things were looking up again for King Coal.
When I started in the industry, I was told, you've got a job for life. You've got a job for life, lad, as they say, around these parts.
I talked to David Murray one night at his local pub. The mines had been nationalised after World War II, and jobs there felt safe for a while.
Things started to change in the early 80s.
Murray remembers it well. It was 1984, and the government-backed Coal Board announced plans to close some inefficient mines.
1984, and a war of attrition engulfs the British coal industry.
Most of the country's miners staged a bitter strike to protest the move.
And it was a defining, deeply scarring moment in the history of British industrial relations.
Sean McLaughlin took me to the mine where he was working at the time.
Hey, mate. Listen, I'm just at gate with a reporter from BBC World Service.
In 1984, this spot, just outside the gate, was chaos.
The road would be totally blocked.
There were at least 6,000 miners, perhaps many more.
There were thousands of pickets.
Facing them were 700 policemen in full riot gear.
There would be the police there with the horses and the dogs trying to clear the road.
There was an atmosphere of real tension.
Miners threw bricks and punches. Cops put miners in headlocks and dragged them, kicking and screaming, from the front lines. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had run on a platform of busting up union power, and she waged a PR war against the picketers.
Mr. Chairman, what we have seen in the past few weeks is not picketing at all. It is intimidation. It is unlawful assembly.
Yeah. All the publicity on TV was showing the miners as being basically thugs. So there's a lot of bad feeling towards the miners.
The country watching this all on TV was bitterly divided. Some supported the police, others backed the miners.
It split families, it split brothers.
Some miners crossed the picket line to go back to work. McLaughlin didn't.
Obviously, with being a third-generation miner, you knew that it was a sin to break the strike and what they call scab. I ended up on strike for 12 months. I'd been married a couple of years. Life was really tough.
Union leaders gambled that the country couldn't keep the lights on without coal. But the lights stayed on, and the violence had turned public opinion against the miners. After a year, they admitted defeat and went back to work.
And the government was free then to carry out the pit closure program at an accelerated rate.
Now, none of this had anything to do with the harmful effects of burning coal. Climate change wasn't really on anyone's radar at the time. It was all about economics and political power. The UK was actually still burning a lot of coal. It was often just cheaper to import it than dig it up at home. But the failed strike meant that the number of miners in the UK plummeted from 139,000 in 1984 to just 7,000 a decade later. And the miners' influence in London collapsed as well. Former miner David Murray says the strike changed everything.
There was a sense before the strike of the industry being so important. And I just think the industry lost that importance politically, economically, and everything.
And that loss of influence would end up paving the way for another big shift for coal here, one that almost nobody saw coming in the 1980s.
My government will publish a bill on climate change as part of its policy to protect the environment.
When Queen Elizabeth delivered that speech to Parliament in 2006, climate change was emerging as a big issue in the UK. But the country had a problem. To really cut its carbon pollution, it would have to do something unthinkable a generation before. It would have to not only stop mining coal, but stop burning it, too. We'll hear that part of the story tomorrow.
The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler in Yorkshire, England. Tomorrow, how Britain has largely stopped burning coal, and what's different back here in the U.S. I'm Marco Werman. As a kid, Aisha Ali's last name meant some people looked at her a certain way.
After years and years of those prejudices, I decided, okay, if that's who I am, that's how I'm going to be. I'm going to be a professional Arab.
A professional Arab from Pittsburgh. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Aisha Ali has a remarkable story. It's really a story about what we know about ourselves, what we don't know, and what we do with the knowledge once we finally understand who we are. Ultimately, Aisha Ali's story is a unique one about identity. She grew up thinking she was one thing, only to find out later she was something else. This path of self-discovery took her to the Middle East and North Africa, where she collected recordings like this. Aisha Ali went on to create her own record label and releasing music that comes from the banks of the Nile. Oh, and before that, she'd been a dancer in an L.A. nightclub, just two of the many defining moments in Aisha Ali's life. She tells her unlikely story in the Lost Notes podcast out of KCRW in Santa Monica. This particular episode is called Searching for the Root, The Incredible Story of Aisha Ali. Arshia Haque is the producer of the episode, and she joined us to introduce this excerpt from Lost Notes. Arshia, tell us who Aisha Ali is and what led you to her.
I first learned of Aisha because over the years I'd been doing my own field work in Southwest Asia and North Africa, and I'd been collecting records and making recordings for my curatorial project Discostan. And some of those records just got under my skin. They were mostly field recordings, and it was fascinating to me that in a sea of male anthropologists, here was this solitary female figure who went out on her own in the 70s and did this all on her own label. And it turned out that she lived just 30 minutes from where I live right now, so I was able to find her.
Yeah, that's kind of extraordinary. Just down the road, there she was. We're going to hear the phrase belly dancer a few times in the excerpt to your podcast. And one of the things that led Aisha Ali to ethnomusicology was that decision to become a belly dancer. And I gather there were some editorial discussions as to whether or not to use that phrase, belly dancer. What was that discussion like, and what does Aisha Ali think of the term?
Well, to be honest, some dancers still use that term for convenience because it's widely known, even if they kind of cringe while they use it. But frankly, it's kind of exoticizing and orientalist. It immediately conjures the I Dream of Jeannie stereotype. But there's so many different forms of dancing from that part of the world, and I feel like belly dance reduces all of the complexity and legitimacy of these forms. And Aisha herself prefers the term Middle Eastern dancer to belly dancer.
So, Aisha, you're going to stick around to chat a bit more. But first, let's sit back and listen to some of Searching for the Root, the incredible story of Aisha Ali.
I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My mother's family was Italian, and they didn't approve of my mother's selection of a man with an Arab name. So for years, we didn't know we were Arab. We just knew that for some reason we weren't accepted in the family. And it wasn't until I put two and two together with a classic name like Ali. Of course, I should have known because my grandfather wore a tabouche. And he decorated the house with Islamic tiles. He had paintings of Islamic themes. There was even a tapestry in the living salon with a dancing girl dancing on a carpet with all of these people sitting on the carpet around her, clapping and playing musical instruments. These things all fascinated me. I'm sure they influenced me. Since I was a little girl, my mother would give me a quarter, and I would go with my little boyfriend, and we would walk to the big avenue and spend the afternoon in the movie theater with Tony Curtis and Piper Laurie and like Ali Baba something, and all those old Hollywood corny movies showing women wearing veils that went like this across their face, but you could see through them.
You still don't trust me.
If I have misjudged you, princess, remember only that the slave girl I once held in my arms, I loved truly.
That's where I got my first images of what Arab women were like. And the whole romantic notion of the harem, where it was forbidden for men to go, and all the women had nothing to do all day but look beautiful and lounge around, take baths, and eat grapes. When I was 12 or 13, my mother gave me Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, and I used to play it over and over and over and fantasize about it. I read all the Arabian Nights by Burton, and anything I could get my hands on that was about the Middle East. And I read about women who had traveled and made maps and made friends with Arab nobility, but they were English women. I knew that people thought of me as exotic, even though I'm all American, right? Second generation. But I was never accepted as that. And when I tell them that I was born in Pittsburgh, they laugh. So after years and years of those prejudices and being relegated to a certain group, I decided, okay, if that's who I am, that's how I'm going to be. I'm going to be a professional Arab. I always knew I wanted to move to a warmer place. I wrote in my high school yearbook that I wanted to move to California and I wanted to travel. So when I finished high school, I was just turning 18, and I got on the bus and I traveled here on a Greyhound.
It was 1960 when Aisha got on the bus that took her from Pittsburgh to LA. And I think as soon as she arrived, she was really struck by how cosmopolitan the city was.
The thing that I best liked here was that suddenly I was no longer different. It was like a new kind of freedom. I felt like I fit in. There were exotic women. Some of them were Mexican, some of them were Indian, some of them were Italian, French, Armenian. It was like a potpourri of nationalities. So I felt like I was where I belonged.
Not long after arriving here, she started taking some acting and dance classes, and her roommate at the time was an aspiring young actor named Frank Langella.
I met him in acting school, and I became his acting partner. And one day we were going to go out. He happened to pass by my bedroom while I was changing, and he saw that I had these long legs. And he said, "Oh my God, you're all legs. You should be a dancer." We went out and we bought all these Arab records, and then we would give parties in my apartment, which was bare of any furniture, so we had plenty of room, and we didn't have money for food and stuff, so we would invite all these people and tell them to bring things, and then I would dance.
What were the records that you bought?
One of them was called Flame of Araby Orchestra with Karaman.
Come on, honey, let's go on. Come on, honey.
And I danced to that, and everybody thought I was so wonderful. But it was sort of a combination of what I had learned in the primitive dance class and trying to make it fit with the Arabic music. But it was fun, and we believed in ourselves. So it worked. I had a job, and I became a draftsperson. And there was going to be a party for the engineers, and that night I met the president of the Arab student group. And he told me that there was going to be an international festival at UCLA, and the Arab students were going to have a belly dancer. But then I said, "I'm a belly dancer." So he thought this was wonderful. Here was a young Arab girl, and she'll perform. So one of the Arab students was Mustafa Akkad. And to make money, he would put on marhajans and haflas and rent some of the big nightclubs in Hollywood, like the Moulin Rouge or any big fancy nightclub. That was the days when they still had them the way they used to look back in the 40s. And I was hired because I was young and cute and Arab. And that's where I got the feeling of the whole Arab culture of entertainment and music and dance. And I became an Arab because they right away embraced me and adopted me. And I felt like I finally belonged somewhere. When I started in Hollywood, the first place I danced was called the Torch Club on Hollywood Boulevard and Las Palmas. And it catered mostly to older men who would come in with their cigars and drink mataxa. And it was owned by a woman by the name of Helen Capello. And she was a tough woman. And she sort of looked at me sideways and she said, "You have a costume?"
And I said, oh, yes, I have a very nice costume. And she said, I pay $15, but that's for good dancers. And I said, well, I'm not a good dancer, but I wouldn't work for less than $15. So she hired me. When I performed at the Torch Club and saw how the men treated me as an object, I really wasn't prepared for that. As I would dance by their table, they would reach out and pinch me or grab me and spit on silver dollars and slap them on my body. And I was offended. So I wasn't a very gracious dancer. I didn't smile and I wasn't happy in trying to please them. I kind of danced with a chip on my shoulder. I stuck it out because the dance itself and the music, there was no question, I loved it. I adored it. And it took up all my energy and interest. But the scene at the cabarets was another story that I had to deal with. So in order to have the one thing, I had to contend with the audience and their reactions and the owners and how they treated me. But I learned to adapt and stuck to my guns that I would not relent and do anything that I didn't approve of. And somehow they accepted me that way.
We don't have time to feature the entire Aisha Ali story, but we've got Arshia Hawk back with us. She's the producer of Searching for the Root, the incredible story of Aisha Ali. So Arshia, that was one portion of the podcast, but there's much more to Aisha's story. Can you just briefly tell us where her story goes from there?
So at the end of the 60s, Aisha was looking beyond the cabaret circuit where she was working as a dancer. She'd started teaching her own dance classes. She'd appeared on television and performed in cities all over the U.S. But I think what took her to the next stage of her journey was hearing actual field recordings from North Africa, which really sparked her desire to go there herself and explore what that music sounded like in its original form.
You know, what I found really fascinating about her story is that it shows kind of how fluid identity can be. I mean, she believes at one point she's Italian-American and then later realizes she has these Arab roots, and she embraces that and leads her to discovery and a deep, almost zealous embrace of who she is. As she says, at one point in the podcast, she became a professional Arab.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely an incredible story of identity and, in a way, taking control of your own identity and forging your own image. And I think that's one of the things that really fascinates me about Aisha's story.
So since she's so associated with music, Arshia, let's go out with one of the songs that kind of impressed you when you first learned about Aisha Ali. Can you select one of those recordings she made, one that you like and took you deeper into her story?
There's so many haunting recordings in Aisha's catalog of recordings, but one of my favorites is Yabahea, which was recorded near Luxor. And she tells an amazing story about finding this man and waking him up in the middle of the night to sing this song that she had heard while she was studying at UCLA. So it's absolutely gorgeous and haunting.
Well, thank you so much for this, Arshia Hawk. Really appreciate this, and you're telling the story of Aisha Ali.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful to be able to share this story.
That's producer Arshia Hawk, and you can hear more of Aisha Ali's story on KCRW's podcast, Lost Notes. Download it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Angela Merkel is in political trouble. The German chancellor is getting major heat from within her own coalition. The issue is Merkel's immigration policy. Kind of sounds familiar. In 2015, Merkel took an open-door approach toward migration. Now Germany's interior minister, Horst Seehofer, wants Merkel to take a tougher line on migrants crossing into Germany from Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia. What makes this all the more politically precarious for Merkel is that Seehofer's party is part of Merkel's own governing coalition. If that's not enough, President Trump stepped into the political debate via Twitter. To talk all of this through, let's go to my BBC colleague Jenny Hill in Berlin. So just give us some background on why this change in immigration policy is such an important issue for the Christian Social Union, the CSU party.
Yeah, in some respects, it's not actually too much of a change. You know, Angela Merkel has been gradually, very quietly hardening her stance on asylum policy, having promised Germany that she won't give them a repeat performance of 2015. Horst Seehofer, her interior minister, wants to implement a plan, one part of which is to turn away migrants from the German border if they've already registered in another EU country or sought asylum in another EU country first. That's part of the system as it used to be. She doesn't want to do that because she says what you need to do really is look at this as a whole, get a European solution to this, because you can't just send a migrant back from the German border into Austria. He says, I'm going to do it anyway. Now, normally, an interior minister would get fired for such open rebellion.
Right.
But Mrs. Merkel is having to really just take this mutiny because, as you say, he leads the Bavarian Christian Socialists. They are the Bavarian sister party to Mrs. Merkel's conservatives. Their alliance forms the very heart of this coalition government, which in itself is very fragile.
Now, the CSU, the Christian Social Union, met today to decide whether to accept or reject Seehofer's plan. What did they agree to?
Basically, they back him. They say that they want him to go ahead and implement this plan. Mrs. Merkel's off to a European summit of leaders in a week or so's time. Today, we saw a bit of a temporary ceasefire. Mr. Seehofer said, well, I'm going to implement this plan, but we'll wait. Let's see if Mrs. Merkel can make good on her promise to deliver a European or at least a bilateral agreement with a couple of other countries, Greece, Italy, maybe. If she can do that, then maybe things are different. But he's kind of sticking to his guns here. The reason most people think he's doing this is because Bavaria goes to the regional polls in October. You'll have heard of the far-right anti-migrant party Alternativa für Deutschland, AfD.
Right.
They're making gains in Bavaria. So Mr. Seehofer is grandstanding, really, ahead of an election. It's a position which is putting an awful lot of strain on this government, and it could still all fall apart. And it's difficult, actually, when you look at the law here, to really determine who has got the power on this particular issue. He reckons he's got the power to just go ahead and impose this crackdown at the border. If he decides to do that, then she'll probably have no choice but to sack him. And then, as I say, the government falls apart.
Yeah, so what kind of power does Merkel have right now?
Merkel's in a really interesting position. As you know, last September, she did pretty poorly in the general election here. That meant it was difficult for her to form a government. Her first choice of coalition fell apart too. She's very, very weak politically here at the moment. Although it's worth pointing out that she's still Germany's most popular politician. She's got a 50% approval rating here. So in some ways, she's not doing too badly. I think if she doesn't, though, come back with some kind of agreement, some kind of consensus amongst other European leaders, then she might start to see more problems.
I don't know if you are aware, but President Donald Trump has been tweeting about immigration in Germany. Crime in Germany is way up. Big mistake made all over Europe in allowing millions of people in who have so strongly and violently changed their culture. Have any politicians responded to that?
Not particularly. I mean, there is a general sense of outrage here, and that's for a number of reasons, and it's probably worth tackling some of the points he makes. First of all, crime. Crime in Germany, it's actually the lowest it's been since 1992. The figures don't add up there. Again, the number of migrants, he talks about millions of migrants. Bear in mind that 2015, 2016, the number of migrants who came into Germany was around a million. That was the crisis. So, you know, maybe that starts to feel a bit inflated too. And of course, you know, regardless of your view of Angela Merkel, you can't help but feel sorry for the woman. She's had this dreadful row going on. She was forced last night to watch Germany defeated in its first World Cup football
match.
That
must have been rough.
And now, you know, and Donald Trump's now putting the boot in too. I think she'll feel that because behind the scenes in Berlin, you know, no one's under any illusions. There's no way that Germany enjoys the transatlantic relationship that it did when Barack Obama was in power. Angela Merkel and Donald Trump couldn't be more different. So perhaps it's no surprise, but I think it's probably viewed as rather unhelpful.
My BBC colleague Jenny Hill speaking with us from Berlin. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
More on that World Cup upset for Germany yesterday. Germany was upset, not Mexico. Mexico wasn't supposed to win. I know the world soccer editor William Troop wishes he were in Russia, but he is paying close attention stateside. So, William, how you feeling today about this?
That win, Marco, was amazing. I mean, the first half from Mexico against the World Cup holders, Germany, was just absolutely amazing. They dominated Germany. They deserved to go ahead. And then, you know, the second half, they really like hung on by their fingernails to that win. And it was just magical to watch. And I wasn't even in Russia or Mexico. So I was really excited. I was born in Mexico, so Mexico is my team.
Yeah, you're down in Washington, D.C. this week. Did you watch it with any other Mexicans in a bar or anything?
Absolutely. I watched it with a bunch of other Mexicans in a bar and one German. He wasn't very happy at the end, but everybody else was.
Yeah. So those emotions, that's a really natural segue to bring in our Livable Planet editor, Peter Thompson. Yeah, this is actually about the environment, Peter. I heard there was an earthquake when Irving Lozano scored that goal yesterday. Is there any truth to that?
There is a sliver of truth to that, yes. The Institute of Geological and Atmospheric Investigations, which is a Mexican research outfit, is saying this was not an earthquake, but it was a geologic event, a seismic event, which their instruments were able to detect.
And the geologists aren't ascribing this to any other event?
They are saying it was an artificial event, most likely ascribed to the fans jumping up and down. This kind of thing actually has happened before, including in another soccer game.
Really?
When Peru qualified for this World Cup last year by beating New Zealand, William, I got a question for you, though. I mean, did you cause your own little earthquake in D.C. yesterday when this happened?
I was just going to say, I can tell you one thing about this, that the ground beneath the bar where I was watching this with several Mexican fans definitely shook.
Well, it was a spectacular match, but let me ask you something that is a little less celebratory. Now, I'm told Mexico has more fans in Russia than any country, except, of course, for Russia. But I hear some of them, the Mexico fans, have been making some pretty offensive chants. What's going on there?
What's happening with the chants is an ongoing story. Mexico has been fined before because there's a tradition, a bad tradition by Mexican fans to sing a homophobic slur, usually directed specifically at the goalie of the other team. So this happened again, despite many warnings against the fans, despite economic fines of millions of dollars against the Mexican Soccer Federation. But as long as the fans don't suffer any consequences themselves, I think that it's going to be almost impossible to get that to stop. And I just have to say, I mean, my view as a fan and as someone who comes from Mexico is that this is absolutely inexcusable. There's no cultural excuse to be saying this chant, and it really should stop.
Peter Thompson, William Troop, thank you both.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Marco.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.